Hume is so special. This is my 11th year at Hume. It's hard to believe. And I have absolutely loved every second of being here, except when I got really sick 4 years ago, Chuck, and almost died after I got home, when I finally got home. But even then, that was a special time. That was a really, really amazing time. Last year, I was here opening the summer session just like this year, and I wanted to bring something really relevant to you. I had my whole family with me, three generations. We had a blast all week long. And my kids have kind of grown up getting to come here from time to time and be a part of some of the activities. If you've never been here before and you're on summer staff, let me tell you something. You're in for a life-changing experience this summer. You're going to go away a better person than when you got here, and you're going to also help other people do that as well when they go back off the hill. It's a really special place. Very thankfully, I get to travel around the world, and I see a lot of different ministries and a lot of different places, meet a lot of different people. There is no place like Hume, Nathan, no place. I just can't find a ministry anywhere that has a bigger impact overall than Hume. So it's an anointed, special place, and it's an anointed and blessed and special time for you that you are here. Whether you're a full-timer and you live here like Jay or whoever all the time, or whether you're just here for the summer, man, I'm telling you, it's a very, very special appointment that God has given you. The volunteers, you guys and ladies are amazing, what you do and how much you give of yourself. The donors, it takes everybody. And you're only as good as those around you. And I'm telling you, God is working through all of you, so thank you. And I'm so thankful just to get to be a part of this. Chuck, thanks for inviting me back. And I'm excited, really, really excited. Now, having said that, let me show you what I want to do as far as my part here, which is very small compared to everything else. But if you'll notice on the screen, the theme that I want to bring you this week is going to be walking in the steps of Jesus. And if you guys could pull up the topic, if you don't mind, can you get to that on the PowerPoint? We'll get there in a minute, maybe. If not, I'll just move right ahead. But that's going to be the theme, is walking in the steps of Jesus. And what I have chosen to do is look at the ages of his life on earth as he stepped out of timelessness into time that we know as clock time or years time, age, in other words. And I want us to look at the increments in his life. For example, this morning, we're going to start at his birth. We're going to look at him as a toddler. Tonight, we're going to follow in his footsteps from the ages of 2 to 6. And you'll be amazed as to where those years were lived, Egypt. And so my wife and I went to Egypt. And I did a special documentary that I'm going to debut tonight here it was done years ago, but we have put it together, and we're going to show you a lot of video of where Jesus lived from the age of 2 to 6 and what he saw. That's tonight. Then tomorrow night, you guys are not going to be able to get to it at all? All right. I'll look at my cheat notes. Tomorrow night, we're going to do something between the age of 12 and 30. We don't know much about Jesus between those ages, so I went and studied some extra biblical resources to find out at least some of the ideas that people have about Jesus from the age of 12 to the age of around, I'd say around 6 to 30, but especially 12 to 30. And we're going to look at a special archaeological discovery that has been taking place for about the last 80 years that sheds new light on what we understand about how Jesus grew up. Then, on Tuesday night, we're going to look at Jesus' coming of age, and that was at the age of 30, when he launched his public ministry. We're going to take a look at what happened, what great event happened up on a mountain in the wilderness that helped him to launch into his public ministry and begin to reveal that he's the Messiah. On Wednesday night, we're going to kind of fast forward a little bit through to the end of his ministry. You all know he died, right? You all know he resurrected. 6 weeks he lived in a body that had been resurrected. That had never happened before. Are you kidding me? Nobody in the history of the world believed that a human body could be bodily resurrected and then live in that same body. And he did. All right, and what happened during that 6 weeks? There were special appearances that took place to special people for a special reason. That's going to be Wednesday night. Then Thursday night, we're going to come to the very last hour, the last minute of his life in a physical body on earth, and we're going to see something that happened that is actually mentioned in what's called the kerygma, the core gospel. And yet the church today, while the church focuses on all the other elements that are mentioned in the core gospel, the church never, hardly ever talks about this one. And I think we need to reclaim it and get it back into its true biblical perspective of kerygma, of core gospel. So that's where we're going this week. And I encourage you, if you can, to come at night if you don't have anything else to do. But this morning, I want us to begin by looking at that very first occasion in Jesus leaving timelessness and coming to earth as a baby. I want to start with a question. Here we go. If God had chosen the 21st century for Jesus to be born rather than the first century, and if he had chosen this area in California rather than over in Galilee or Bethlehem in Judea for Jesus to be born, what one person would Jesus choose to bear Jesus, or would God choose to bear Jesus? What one woman? Does anybody have an answer? Who do you think it'd be? Guys, you have an opportunity to make brownie points if you yell your mom. Can they talk here without going to hell, Dathan, in church? Okay, you can talk. Who? Your mom, there you go. Your mom. Who? Grace? Grace Burr. Okay. What about Beth Moore? Anybody study Beth Moore's materials? You know, she fills convention centers and speaks to 20,000 women at a time. She's awesome. What about maybe you think about your pastor back at your church and you think about his wife? She'd be good, wouldn't she? Or you had this godly grandmother that prayed you up, right, through all that craziness. She'd be good, right? What one person would God choose to bear Jesus Christ? I'm going to suggest to you that while those that you answered might be good choices, that rather God would pick a young teenager. Because that's what he did. I did some research from studies by Joachim Jeremias, and he wrote this famous book called Jerusalem in the Time of Jesus. And basically he said, here's the culture for marriage and for birth back then. For a young lady to become engaged during the first century in the region of Jesus, she was normally 12 years old. And the young man was normally 18 on average. And the parents of both would know each other. They would get together and kind of prearrange the marriage. And the father and the son would go to the girl and her dad and say, okay, we're kind of prearranging this marriage. And the young boy would ask, you know, would you take this cup? And he gives her this little bit, you know, this little cup with this little bit of wine in it. And he would say, do you take this cup, which represents the blood of my covenant of my family? And will you accept that and become part of the blood of this family? And if she sipped it, then she's saying yes. If she didn't, she had the choice. She could turn it down. And that's where they come up with this tradition of, you know, they take the pictures at weddings and all that. And if she did, then the young man would say to her, okay, I'm going to go back to my father's house and build a room there. And someday, whenever my dad says and gives word, because he's the only one that can, I'm going to come back and get you, and you can go and live with me for the rest of your life. That's the culture. And so she would go get her bride stuff already and have her hope chest already, and she would wait. It might be 3 months, it might be 6 months, it might be a year. And the boy would go home and he'd build his room. He'd want it to look like that, but I doubt it would. And he would wait for his dad to say, all right, let's go get her. And finally the dad would say, all right, let's go get her. So the wedding party would all get together and they would announce their arrival with this trumpet, and she'd be ready, right? She's not looking for oil. She's already got some for her lamp. And so she's in there and she's all excited and she puts on her bride's dress and they get there. And so then he goes in and they consummate the marriage. Is how they did it. And the attendant to the groom would stand at the door and wait. And when it's, you know, all consummated, the young man would say to the guy, okay, all right, we're married. And he'd go, they're married, start the party. And they'd have a 7-day wedding feast. All right? That was the culture. And so I really believe that God chose a teenager to bear Jesus because that was the way it worked back then. I think Mary was probably around 12 or 13, somewhere in that age group, when she had already been approached by Joseph. It was arranged, and she was waiting on him to build his room. He's a carpenter after all, right? And he's going to come back and get her. And that's when this angel stepped in and messed it all up. And the angel said to her, oh yeah, by the way, you're going to be pregnant. And she's going to go, wait a minute. I had this class at school. I know about how that works. It's impossible. My parents had that talk with me. That hasn't happened. I can't be pregnant. And yet the angel said, well, you will be by the Holy Spirit. And by the way, Joseph was going to divorce her because that engagement thing, this is a very, very serious binding contract. So he was going to actually put her away privately. So the angel said, No, this is of God. She hadn't been sneaking around with some guy. I mean, this is crazy. Just think about that. Talk about a theme for Hume Camp one year. That story right there alone would do it. That'd be amazing, all right? And we're going to continue with that idea through this lesson, all right? And so here they are. They're in this crazy period of time, and she starts to grow. And, of course, you know what the public's going to say. Oh, scandal. And so he put her away privately for a while. And then the time came. 9 months down the road. I love how Max Lucado, the author, put it in one of his books early on called God Came Near. I'm just going to read it. Here's what he said. The noise and bustle began earlier than usual in the village. As night gave way to dawn, people were already on the streets. Vendors were positioning themselves on the corners of the most heavily traveled avenues. Store owners were unlocking the doors to their shops. Children were awakened by the exciting barking of the street dogs and the complaints of the donkeys pulling carts. The owner of the inn had awakened earlier than most in the town. After all, the inn was full. All the beds were taken. Every available mat or blanket had been put to use. And soon all the customers would be stirring, and there would be a lot of work to do. One's imagination is kindled thinking about the conversation of the innkeeper and his family at the breakfast table. Did anyone mention the young couple's arrival from the night before? Did anyone ask about their welfare? Did anyone comment on the pregnancy of the girl on the donkey? Perhaps. Perhaps someone raised the subject, but at best it was raised, not discussed. I mean, there was nothing that novel about them. They were possibly one of several families turned away from the inn that night. Besides, who had time to talk about them when there was so much commerce and excitement in the air? Augustus had done the city of Bethlehem a favor when he decreed that a census should be taken. Who could remember when such commerce had hit that little village? No, it's doubtful that anyone mentioned the couple's arrival or wondered about the condition of the girl. They were too busy. The day was upon them. The day's bread had to be made. The morning's chores had to be done. There was too much to imagine that the impossible had occurred, that God had entered the world as a baby. Do you know how ridiculous that sounds? Do you know how crazy it would be to think that the God who created the world, who lives in timelessness, would project himself under the authority of and into the hands of human beings that he had created himself that were finite, not infinite, who lived under the clock? They were under time, not out of time. And be projected into their hands to the point that he knew they would kill them. He knew it up front, and he did it anyway. Do you know how crazy that is? That doesn't fit in Greek mythology with their gods. That doesn't fit with any other mythology in the world about gods. It's truth upside down, so to speak. It's everything on its head. And in this moment of splendorous love, God left the golden throne room, the angels watching in this awestruck silence. And he entered the womb of a teenage peasant girl. And he was given birth to. And with this prunish red face and a loud cry, God entered the world as a man-child himself. And there were no Fox News or CNN news cameras rolling. There was no Jerusalem Post article that was written about it. No headlines, no reporters with flashbulbs popping. There was no red carpet laid out, no Hollywood celebrities in the backgrounds or the foreground so they can get their press too and take advantage of the story. You don't have any of that going on here. All you have is this little room that's like a cave room, a feeding trough for a bed, hay for a mattress, an audience of smelly animals, no dignitaries anywhere, bewildered shepherds, and a sleepy carpenter standing by watching. You have majesty in the midst of the mundane. You've got omnipotence in the very midst of the ordinary itself. And the one person in the whole world who best understood what was going on was a teenager, a peasant, a girl named Mary. That's pretty mind-boggling, isn't it? I want you to imagine how Hume would build a set for Mary's and Joseph's house as Jesus is growing up in it. Just imagine the creativity that would be in that set. It would be in the town of Nazareth. It would be overlooking a hill, and you have this vista, and then you'd have the house itself and all the furniture that would be first century, built by, of course, Joseph. And you would have their costumes that they would wear and all of that. Just imagine what that would look like if Hume put their artistic skills to that. Now, understand, it really happened. There really was that house. There really was those clothes, or were those clothes. It really happened. Now, I don't know exactly how it happened, so let me just kind of theorize a little bit. One day, let's say you're Mary. If you're a lady, you role play Mary. If you're a man, I want you to role play Joseph. And you're sitting at home there in your house. It's just a typical day. Let's say it's around 85. So Jesus is going to be somewhere maybe around 8 years of age. And you get up one morning, you heat up a pot of Folgers decaffeinated camel milk, and you prepare some fig pancakes, and you ring the dinner bell. You're announcing to your whole family, okay, breakfast is ready, and they all begin to slumber into the kitchen, and they're drowsy, they're only half awake. You know that, you get it, right? You hadn't had your coffee yet. And you say, good morning, Joseph, or good morning, Mary, depending upon which of those you're role-playing. And then little Jesus walks in. He's dragging a teddy sheep in one hand and a blanket in the other. And he's followed by a little sister. And then there comes little brother James. And then there's another couple of brothers. And I think there were four or five of them all together. And they're following him. He's the oldest. And you all gather around your breakfast table, which, of course, Joseph built. And you ask little Jesus to say the blessing before you eat your food. And after he finishes quoting Psalm 119, you then begin to eat your cold fig pancakes. And as you eat, a locust flies through the window, and it lands on your head. And you grab the locust swatter, and you swat yourself, and a hair falls, and it slowly, in slow motion, falls into your camel milk. And Jesus goes, oops, there goes number 42,296. After breakfast, it's time for your daily devotional, and you sit down with little Jesus and the other kids, and you get out a copy of the Tiny Tots Septuagint Reader, and it's written by Rabbi Chuck Barbozman, and you're to teach Jesus how he created the world today. After lunch, Jesus runs in from the backyard. He tattletales on something his sister's thinking. And then supper rolls around. You have supper. After supper, you know, the stars are out. It's a beautiful night there, and you go outside on the back porch, which, of course, Joseph built, on the deck there, and you're lying on your back. And as any good parent would do, you want to teach your children about the beautiful universe. And you're up there and you're trying to count the stars. And Jesus succeeds. And he even tells you about something you can't see. Finally, it's time for bed. And so you tuck all your kids in, Jesus as well. And they're all asleep. Maybe just two fingers in their mouth or however they did it. And you finally get back to your bedroom. It's been a long day. And you get down and you kneel down at the foot of your bed and you begin to pray. And the thought hits you like a locomotive. The God to whom I'm praying is asleep in his footy pajamas in the next room. You know, there's a movie I love to watch. It's called The Princess Bride, one of the greatest theological movies in the history of the world. And there's a word in it that really fits. You know what it is? Say it with me, you know it. Inconceivable. This is inconceivable right here. This is crazy. This is ridiculousness times 1,000, all right? You get this? Have you really thought about this? God coming to the world as a baby, it must have been mind-boggling to raise Jesus. Think of all the questions that Mary or Joseph had to face as Jesus came to them. Or even if Jesus, as they were just doing stuff, they're teaching God how to walk. They're teaching God how to talk. They're bandaging God's scraped knee and saying, it's okay, you'll heal it. They're holding his hands all night to keep him from scratching the chicken pox. Wondering, why did you make chicken pox? They're hugging him close when he's crying because his third-grade girlfriend dumped him for another guy named Fred. And then he's saying stuff like, I just thought about turning him into a toad, but I didn't. What do? You just keep your mouth shut. As they tried to answer the questions like, why did God make sloths so slow? Where do where do chickens come from? I know they come from eggs, but did God make the egg first or the chicken first? Where do babies come from? They had to deal with this. And they knew who he was. They knew he was a miracle. They raised him and nurtured him, and they knew all along that there was going to be an eternal mission, something that would be life-changing for everyone in the world and in the history of the world. Now, are you feeling awkward yet, Mary? You feeling awkward yet, Joseph? What an incredibly hard job it must have been. And here's another factor I want you to think about. Not only did God choose a teenager, but God chose a sinner. You're saying, wait a minute, do you know something about Mary I don't know? No. You know that she was a human being, right? And you know that the only human being who ever reached the age of maturity, mentally speaking, sinned, right? Except for Jesus. So Mary is disqualified from perfection because she's not Jesus. She sinned. We sin, right? Anybody here not sin? Good. We don't have to do the sermon on lying. We've all sinned. So did Mary. So did Joseph. And yet God chose her and God used her in spite of her sin. Now, is that comforting to you? That God can choose you and use you in spite of your sin. Not just mistakes or bad decisions. That's the way a lot of preachers say it now. No, it's sin. It's sin. It's wrong. It separates you from God when you sin. And he can bring that separation away. He can bring you back to him in his forgiveness. He can use you powerfully in spite of what you've done. You say, well, you don't know everything I've done. God's bigger than your sin. And his love is greater than your sin. And he can forgive your sin and work with you. So that doesn't hold you back. God can use you in a powerful way to do things just like he did her. That's good news. And let me tell you something, all right? It is the 21st century. And we are 2,000 plus years away from that event happening. But I'm telling you, God is still looking for a teenager right now, just like he was back then, to bear Jesus Christ in the world. He's looking for a young adult. He's looking for people in their 20s. He's looking for people in their 30s right now, married or not married, guy or girl. He's looking for somebody who will stand up and say, I will bear Jesus in the world. I will be his witness. I will show Jesus to everybody that I come in contact with. I will live full out proclaiming Jesus Christ is Lord. I will reflect him in my life. Are there repercussions to making those claims these days? Yes, more so ever in the United States than before. More so ever in Europe than I've ever heard of. Lots of people being killed because they're claiming Jesus is Lord. Some of them getting their heads cut off because of it. Yeah, there's repercussions to it. You willing to do it? God's looking. God's wanting someone who will bear Christ. He's always used young people. This is nothing new to God. When you look at the Bible, you look at the sons of Noah. Some of them were teenagers when they began working on the ark, not ever having experienced rain. Because I don't think it ever rained before the days of the ark, until the ark was ready, and then it began to rain. I think everything was watered from underneath. So they're building this ark for some reason that they don't really understand, but they're doing it because God told their father to do it. They had great faith. God used them to do something amazing. Or Joseph, he's a teenager when he's in Egypt, and he's so sold out to God that even when Miss Potiphar came along to him and said, hey, let's do this, he's like, no, and he runs, and he's in prison 10 years, and yet he stays faithful to God, so that by the time he dies, do you know, he's told his brothers, he said, whatever you do, you take my bones out of Egypt. Now, tonight, I'm going to do a piece on that, and you're going to see some amazing footage about that. So I'll say no more about it right now. But God used Joseph in a powerful way starting as a teenager. And then there's this guy named Joshua. Did you know Joshua started out as a young man as the primary aide to Moses? And when Moses was up on Mount Sinai, did you know that Joshua was with him? You say, wait a minute, I didn't know that. Well, all you got to do is just read it. It's in Exodus 24:13. He was on the mountain with him. God chose a young man. Everybody else would die if they went across the perimeter at the mountain, but not Joshua. And then you got this guy that comes along, and his name is Samuel. And at the young age of 4, God is using him in a powerful way. You've got young men selected as the perimeter around the giving of the law. They're the other perimeter around the mountain. And if you step across, they got to kill you. God chose the young men to do that. You've got this young man named David who is about 15 when he goes up against that huge, huge Philistine. That was amazing, Chuck, how y'all built that. And he kills him with a rock, cuts his head off, and says, "The battle belongs to the Lord." That was a teenager, changed the course of the whole nation. You've got a little girl who's a Gentile, and she brings her master Naaman to the prophet and says, "This man is a prophet of God. He can tell you what to do to be healed of your leprosy." You've got Josiah, who's only 8 years old when he becomes king. You've got Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, who are taken away into Babylonian captivity by Nebuchadrezzar. And he takes them down to Babylon, and they're eating the king's food and all that stuff, and then they say, "No, we can't do this. They're the sharpest guys in the land. The king's going to raise them up in his palace." And they said, "We can't do this. We don't want to defile our countrymen when they're having to eat just bread and water. We're going to live the same way they do." And, of course, those three of them are thrown in the fiery furnace. And they survive because they believe in their God, not in the king's gods. We still tell the story today, don't we? Oh, yeah, and who brought their lunch to Jesus and it ended up feeding 15,000 people? Do you remember that one? Counting the women and the children. I was a little boy. Yeah, how about that? And then there's this apostle. His name was Mark, and he was probably a teenager when he was chosen, and he was the youngest of the apostles, and tradition says he may have been around the age of 18 when he was chosen. And then you have this young man named Timothy, chosen by the apostle Paul to go and start churches and plant churches and lead churches. You see, God's always use young people in his service. And if you deleted all of the pages in the Bible that portray him using young people in his service and being tuned into young people, the Bible would be significantly decreased in size and significance. I'm going to tell you right now that God is still looking. He's looking for somebody who's going to raise up Jesus Christ in their actions and bear him to many. And you have an opportunity. And that opportunity is headed up the hill right now. And that opportunity is going to be getting off the buses right outside this building here in just a couple of hours. And it's going to be filling the beds and the rooms in this camp. And it's going to be all over the lawn and around on the lake and in the boats. It's going to be at the getting milkshakes. This opportunity is going to be in the place that you eat, all the, and the human beings, all these places. Everywhere you look is going to be opportunity this summer. And these little opportunities are young men and young women who are coming here with lots of baggage. And some of them have already contemplated, possibly even attempted suicide. Some of them have committed sins that you don't even want to mention. Some of them have seen those sins committed. Some of them have been abused physically, mentally. Some of them may have abused. Some of them are going to have some super dark thoughts. And some of them may, if there is not interaction taking place appropriately, grow into something in their life that would be horrific and do horrific things. You have opportunities. And how you treat them and what you say to them and how you live your life before them and with them, even when you think people aren't looking, your actions, your demeanor, the essence of who you are is either going to have a positive impact on them and maybe send them in this direction, or it's going to have a negative impact on them and it could send them in that way. There will be young men and young women saved as a direct result of some of your interaction with them this summer. You have the opportunity of a lifetime. There's going to be thousands of kids here. And some of them are not going to be lovable. Some of them are going to have some really tough actions and say some mean things even to you. How are you going to respond? God, right now, is calling you at Hume for this summer to talk like Jesus talked, to walk like Jesus walked, to love like Jesus loved, to sacrifice like Jesus sacrificed, to know the book and share the book like Jesus knew and shared the Word of God, to pray like Jesus prayed. You may be so tired and you may just need to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and get up there on that hill by the cross, and you may need to pray for an hour because it's so tough with this group that you've been given this week. And then get back in time that you're supposed to be there when they wake up. Because Jesus did do that on numerous occasions. Sometimes he prayed all night. God's looking for a partner. 1 Corinthians 3:9, a fellow worker with God. And God is willing to use you in spite of your sins. So my question to you, Humeites, is this. Are you willing and are you ready to accept God's invitation and rise up and be a perfect reflection of Jesus this summer? If you're willing to take that commitment and make that stance, that commitment, and you really, with all of your heart, in spite of your failures, in spite of your weaknesses, with all of your heart, with all of your mind, with all of your soul, with all of your strength, you're willing to give it all, if it kills you this summer, to be Jesus to these kids that are coming up here. I want you to stand up right now. Now, what I want you to do is I want you to look around. I want you to see you're not alone. You're not alone. God has chosen someone to bear Jesus Christ in 21st century California, at Hume Lake specifically, for a period of this summer, and it is you, but you're not alone. All right? You hold each other accountable. You encourage each other. You pray together. You love one another. You share the tough times together. But always remember this. You don't do anything. Don't say anything without asking the question, what would Jesus do? And then you do it. All right? Are y'all willing to do that? So as a group, let's all say amen, because it means let it be so. You ready? Amen. And let's give God a hand for what he's doing with this great week. All right?